This week, we're going to interview and talk with James Tall. He's a Massachusetts native, spent a lot of time up in upstate New York and in South Florida, always been a rabble-rouser. He drives his friends crazy, arguing politics at any opportunity. Jim served in the Libertarian Party of Florida as a founding member of the St. Lucie County chapter and as a regional representative and treasurer on the state executive committee. Jim and his wife, Lynn, live in Metro Boston's North Shore, and they have five adult children and two grandchildren. And today, we're going to talk about the book that he wrote called The Practical Libertarian, or A Practical Libertarian. This is a book for everyone that is dissatisfied with the current state of politics. It looks at how the extremes on the left and right of the political spectrum craft division to create urgency for their causes, and how that artificial division doesn't represent the interests of most Americans. Tall really lays out a centrist libertarian perspective can unify the middle by not using government for anyone's special interest and restoring some of the liberties that have been eroded. After reviewing much of what is broken in our divisive political atmosphere, Tall examines what moving the government towards a centrist libertarian stance would look like with practical steps that have mainstream support. Jim, thanks very much for coming on the program, sir.
Oh, thanks, Alex, for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm very excited that that I'm your first interview for the series.
Yeah, no, it's kind of fun, actually. It's nice to be able to do it with somebody that you know as well, so you can make it a lot easier. Especially one that I, you know, ideologically, for the years that I've known you, we've had a pretty fair amount of not only agreement when it comes to overall philosophy, but also when it comes to strategy. I would think that there's definitely a lot of overlap when it comes to the course that we would choose to take, which is really nice. Just I know a little bit about you, but the audience doesn't. So if you could just give the audience a little bit of information about yourself that wasn't really in the intro.
Sure. Well, my day job when I'm not thinking about politics is I'm a senior systems consultant for a computer consultancy here in Boston. And what that means is that I help companies develop their computer systems, set them up, manage security, and keep everything for their businesses running well. On a personal level, I live, like you mentioned, in Metro Boston with my wife. We have my grandson living with us. And between the two of us, we have five children and another granddaughter down in Florida.
Nice. And now, how did you get involved in politics? What was the thing that got you to not be apathetic and to get involved? Was there something specific that caused that?
Well, I'm going to date myself, but back in, I think it was the late 70s, Anderson ran for president. And I remember thinking that he was a kind of a breath of fresh air because he was talking about facts. He wasn't twisting emotion to get people to do what he wanted them to do. Similarly, I followed Ross Perot because he came on television and he put up charts and graphs, and he was very much fact-oriented and none of the scare tactics that the Democrats or the Republicans were using. Then I learned about the Libertarian Party, and I found that philosophy-wise, I'm really aligned with them almost 100%. So I've had this book in my head to be written for a long time. It's definitely from a libertarian perspective, but it finally just got to be, time to get it out. We moved up to Boston a number of years ago, and I have the privilege of driving over the Tobin Bridge into work every day. And I have the bunk right, and I can see the spire from the Old North Church to the left, one if by land, two if by sea. And if I look between the buildings at just the right time, I can see the USS Constitution. And tonight for dinner, I'm going to meet a friend right off of Lexington Green. So we're just mired in history here. And I'm reminded every single day of what our founders went through. And seeing the stuff on television with the left and the right, both sides equally, I just felt that this perspective needed to be heard.
Exactly. No, and I think, and a lot of people are very disenchanted with politics right now, and to see that, that you have this art, and you called it an artificial division, which I think is a very good explanation of it. Could you kind of explain what these guys are using and how they're doing these artificial divisions, and why is it being so effective right now?
Sure. So right now it's terribly effective because of social media. And it bothers me that so many people are blaming the social media companies themselves, but it's really just a byproduct. You know, if you think about it, if you log onto Facebook, all of your friends are probably similar political leaning. So all you see is, you know, political rants and memes that are similar to what you've heard. And over time, that just reinforces things in your head, and it makes it hard to get out of that rut. The other thing is, if you think about it, the people that do the most politicizing, the most politicking, are the people on the extremes. And in order to create a sense of urgency and a sense of action, they use those extremes to frighten people. And there's an awful lot of fear-mongering going on also from both sides.
No, I think you're exactly right. And now, what do you think that the role that the media plays in fanning the flames, I guess you could say? I mean, do you think the media has a big role in fanning the flames on both sides in order to keep this stuff going, to where the only thing that you're seeing on TV is this, you know, where these loud voices that you're talking about are the ones that are getting played, where the moderates, the ones that are trying to use facts and logic, are not really being talked about very much?
Yeah, no, the center doesn't get much attention. You know, the center... good news doesn't sell newspapers. Good news doesn't sell ad space. And the idea of a nonpartisan journalist has really gone by the wayside. If you look at all of the news stations, I can look at them and tell you, you know, this one's left. NPR is, you know, I love NPR. I listen to it quite a bit, but it definitely has a left bent. Fox News has a right bent. You know, there's almost like a tit for tat in each direction.
You know what? I'm also a fan of NPR, but I just wanted to ask this question real quick.
Sure.
What do you like about NPR? I think we're probably on the same page here, but what is the thing about NPR that you like about it?
Well, I try and listen to both sides of the conversation, but particularly about NPR is they go further in depth, I think, than just about any other news media. They don't do 30-second or 1-minute stories. You know, Morning Edition and On My Ride Home, they do 3 and 4 minute stories, and they get in and they do a little more in-depth interviewing. They kind of dig at the facts a little bit. To the opposite side of that, recently I've noticed that their journalists are almost interjecting like they're part of the news story. They're kicking back at the interviewee, throwing facts back in their face in the middle of an interview, and finding that a little bit weird.
Yeah, it seems like everybody's going down that road. But do you think it is because the people like NPR have seen what's effective in the other news areas, the ones that you're talking about are doing the error, and then they're mimicking that because of what they've seen? Or do you think that this is a natural course of what's going on with the generation of news reporters that are coming in now more as activists than as honest reporters?
I think it's a little bit of both, but to a great extent, I think they're just kind of keeping up with the Joneses. That's what the other media are doing, and that's what they think that they have to do in order to hold their audience.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And another question is, what part or how much do you think the lack of knowledge of how government actually works? Or how it doesn't work, but the operation of government itself, how much of the role do you think that plays in being able to manipulate the public? When, like, if you don't understand how a bill becomes a law and you don't understand, you know, the jobs of what your local government and your state and your federal government is, like the lack of knowledge on how our country works, how much of a role do you think that plays in being able to take advantage of these situations?
Oh, it's huge. All you have to do is look at Elizabeth Warren, and, you know, every issue that comes up is she has a plan for that. Well, you know, I hate to tell her, but as president, she really doesn't have an awful lot that she can do. It's Congress that does a lot of that passing. Trump does the same thing. I mean, how many of his executive orders have been refuted by the courts and turned down? So, you know, both sides, and you know, going back to Obama as well with DACA, I think eventually that'll get shot down too, because that was really an overstep.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Is that it's weird though that you have this combination of media fanning the flames, ignorance of the general public, and also the way that social media is designed is really it's garbage in, garbage out. Where if you're putting in a bunch of garbage, and everybody wants to look at that stuff, that's the stuff that's coming through even more and more. So in the book where you're talking about this, about trying to unify people around some special interest, what are some of the ways in which you think we can actually do this to create a much better country?
Well, I think we can start by examining how the government is using our division against us. And I think, I'm a big fan of transparency. I don't like secrets. I don't think secrets in the government help anybody except perpetuate the fear of government. So by shining light on some of these artificial divisions, polls show that we agree on an awful lot. The politics of division crowd speak with a very, very loud voice. But if you take away that fear, we agree on almost everything. So I think just shedding light on the facts and bringing out the facts is really what we need to be doing to help get that straight. I talk about ground rules, and I think there are 8 or 10 ground rules that I lay out specifically in the book about how to start that conversation. And one of the conversations is, we need generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP. We don't understand, most people don't understand what government finance looks like. Most of the government has never been audited. We talk about numbers like $1 trillion annual deficit and $23 trillion debt, but that's meaningless to most people. It's just numbers.
Yeah, because they can't really fathom what that actually looks like or why that's going on. And now, do you think that when they're doing things like this, that let me see if I can say it a different way than this. Do you think that when they use some of these division tactics, like race is one that's being used tremendously right now, that you have this being used, they're using those to really try to dissuade people from getting into action, to keep the division going on both sides of the equation? I think that you have an opening right now where you do have people that actually are racist people that are, thinking that they're emboldened, but at the same time, there's people that they're attributing to being racist that aren't actually racist. And it almost, even the argument of race in and of itself gets skewed a lot because if you call everything racist, then nothing's racist.
Yeah, what they've really done is they've weaponized speech. We've come to a point where it's hard to say anything without someone taking offense and finding a way to twist your words into something that, not only wasn't intended, but, from an objective perspective, couldn't possibly be.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. What else do you have? What else are you discussing in the book of ways in which, we can try to unify more as a country, with our neighbors and things like that? How do we kind of shake those that are kind of in this mindset now? How do we shake those people out of the mindset and get them to, really examine the true nature of government and how we can find that there's way more agreement than there is disagreement?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that we can do is we can, give people a real call to action. I spend probably the first third half of the book laying out the symptoms of the broken system, but doing so in a centrist and fair view. I think both sides are guilty of moral hazard and setting up entangling alliances and screwing with the markets, and really coming out with an objective way of looking at these things, we can see that neither party is right here, and that both parties are using the politics of division and using their perspective to divide us. And when we take that fear away, we can start looking at these problems with a new perspective and see that, a lot of these aren't that hard to fix.
Yeah. Would you put an issue like immigration in that category where you have the two sides really kind of ginning up the fear there? And we're also seeing some very negative consequences of that when you have, you know, ICE agents being attacked, as well as, you know, Trump responding by, you know, putting more people in prison or in jail when they're coming across the border. So is an issue like immigration one where, you know, neither side really has the right solution, but the real solution would be much easier?
The real solution is much easier. If you look at, you know, that's one of the things that I talk about in the book, is kind of comparing the three perspectives. You know, the left is aiming towards letting people that are not here legally vote and get driver's licenses. And the right would like to evict everybody that isn't a citizen. Really, the libertarian perspective is very much in the middle. We would like to see safe immigration, but we would also like to see it, you know, much more open. We don't need to prevent people from coming here who just want to go to work. We need workers. You know, we have a shortage of workers driving trucks. We have a shortage of workers, especially in agriculture. But in a number of areas where we could really use these people. So finding a way to take the emotion out of it is really important to getting to the root of the problem. And once we've de-emotionalized it, we let more people in, but we make sure that they're here and we've checked them against criminal lists, and it's not that tough a solution any longer.
Yeah. And taking I would say probably one of the biggest things you said there is being able to take the emotion out of the discussion to have a rational discussion. Because once emotion's in there, then it's almost impossible for a rational discussion to take place. That's pretty much what you're saying, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, when it comes to something along the lines of not to go down specific issues on this, but in the healthcare mm-hmm. industry, this is another one of those areas in which you have two different sides that are really talking that aren't really trying to address the actual, like they'll talk about the problem, but then when it comes to the solution, they're almost looking for more of the same, especially on the left side of it, where, socialized medicine in and of itself is something we already have, and yet their solution is we need more of that.
Yeah. And I think healthcare is a good example of one of the things that I try to illustrate, in that the root of a lot of these problems started with government. As healthcare especially is so artificially manipulated, there's no fair left in this fair market. The government has regulated the heck out of drugs, the heck out of insurance and how companies provide it. And, you know, one of the mechanisms is who gets to deduct the cost of health insurance. Well, why can't anybody deduct the cost of their health insurance? Why is it only deductible if we buy it from our employer?
Yeah, no, exactly. And this is where transparency is one of those areas in which would be much helpful, because they've taken so much of the transparency out of the health insurance, you know, the health area, where you don't know how much it's actually costing for your surgeries or for your treatments or for your visits, that because they've taken all that, the cost driver out of there, we as consumers have a much harder time being able to control the costs.
Absolutely. And I think your coworker Adrian there mentioned it in your last podcast, that, you know, the idea of insurance was originally to cover the big stuff. Like, you get car insurance, it covers your collision and theft, but you don't need it to cover your oil changes.
That's right.
I think it's the same with healthcare. We need to make the cost of it very, very transparent, and perhaps even go back to that kind of, you know, catastrophic care insurance, where you pay for your oil changes, you pay for your annual physicals and your colds and sniffles on your own. But, you know, if you get cancer or if you get hit by a car, then the big stuff is covered.
Yep, exactly. No, and it's really one of those, especially when, and I love that you wrote the book this way, because trying to find the way to unify everyone is going to be the key for us in order to, you know, restore some of the liberties that have been eroded, is that, you know, educating the public on that you're being played, and to be able to fix it that way is definitely one of the areas. What's another, if there was one other issue that you wanted to kind of discuss here today, what would be the other issue where you see the politics of division at play?
Well, not necessarily the politics of division, but certainly the use of government. I talk a lot about moral hazard. And one of those moral hazards is having the government step in and pass the cost of a moral issue to the rest of the people. We have National flood insurance, which is really, really highly subsidized. And the New York Times came out with an article a couple of years ago. There was a house, I think it was in Oklahoma. It was flooded and repaired 22 times to the tune of $1.8 million. It's a $600,000 house. You know, why are the taxpayers covering for someone else's bad decision to build a house in a floodplain? It just makes no sense to me. And shining light on things like this helps us realize that people are using the government to perpetuate their own aims and their own interests. And if it's okay for them to do it, then in 4 years, when we change presidents, it's going to be okay for other people to do it. And it's just a vicious cycle. It goes back and forth and it never ends.
No, exactly. I mean, I do think one of the ways we can try to end this cycle, though, is by letting people know that the jig is up. And I think that your book, you know, A Practical Libertarian, does that. Where can people find this book? How can they get a hold of this book if they were looking for it?
Absolutely. There's a website that I have up. It's called apracticallibertarian.com. And that will give you a link to my bio and a press release about the book. And it will also give you links. The book is available on Amazon as Kindle and as softcover. And this morning I finished recording the book for Audible, and that should be out by the end of the month.
Nice. That's great. No, that's awesome. Yeah, so it's a practicallibertarian.com, and you can get it from Amazon there. We're going to link it when we put this up. When we put the interview up, we'll put it in the links as well so they can go out and get it. Well, James, thank you very much. I really do appreciate it. Thanks for doing the interview today, and we will talk again.
Terrific, Alex. I appreciate you letting me visit with you a while, and have a great day.
All right. Thank you. And thanks for the listeners. We'll be back at a later time.